me how many picofarad of capacitance you're adding by your blob of hot glue in your case. Now, could you tune the individual elements a little bit shorter in length so that they are now a little bit longer in length, so that they're now inductive, so that therefore they can tolerate the extra capacitance of your blob of glue? Absolutely. So there are ways of redesigning the antenna to accommodate the blob of glue and the capacitance it added. In your case, you've now measured by way of the microwave oven the fact that the stuff has low tangent, so it's not wasting your power as far as creating it into heat, but it's detuning the antenna. So you can recompensate the antenna. And even if you don't want to change the design of the antenna itself, change the length of the elements, let me drop. Once you added the weatherproofing hot glue, had a predictable or a measurable amount of standing wave ratio that created. In order for you to now do an impedance match, a rematch of that antenna with that glob of hot glue, relatively easy to do once you understand impedance matching techniques. A coaxial stub in the right location of the right length would correct all of that visuar of that particular antenna. Now, how reproducible would the design be? How uniform could you put the blob of hot glue on serial number 1 through 15 of the antennas? That's another issue. And also, you and I have discussed that did you really need all the performance of this omnidirectional circular polarized antennas? In your particular environment, you've got a fade margin that a simple whip antenna, which doesn't have any more, that is nowhere near as elaborate, would have fit your particular requirement. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick, yeah, so I guess it does not need to have 1.0 or even 1.1 stuff. One of the issues that Jesse is running into is that when he is hand-making these antennas and only measuring the SWR after he has made the antennas, finished making the antennas, he gets very variable results. Some of them have a very good, after the plastidip and hot glue, a pretty good approximately 1.1 SWR, and others have much worse than do maybe. And I'm not sure, how critical this is, but he is, these antennas are being used by sort of very high-profile users. They're people that are sort of top in first-person video flying sport, and he's trying to do the very best for them. So, also once he's made the antenna, he can put more or less hot glue on maybe, but the antenna is pretty much already formed, and with the method he's using right now, can't really change the antenna. He may be able to do something like this stub and have a tunable stub. But, if you're looking at the antenna, it's a very simple build, and the stub itself may add some complexity. I think right now the number of people asking Jesse for antennas estimates he has about 2 months of work ahead of him building these antennas, so more complexity mean lower rate of build. AC2IS.
There's another whole approach here, Bill. When he takes his antenna that worked like a charm, and he puts the glob of hot glue on it, and if he does a wide enough sweep, he may find out that his antenna started off, I'm going to use sample numbers, he may decide his antenna started off at 5.8 gigs, and with the glob of glue, it moves down to 5.7 gigs. It moves the antenna 100 megs down. He may discover that. Therefore, he could design the antenna to start off at 5.9, and when he puts on the glob of glue, it'll take 5.9 and move it down to 5.8, where he wants it. And you already hit on another idea. Let me drop. If he starts off with an antenna that he knows is tuned high in frequency, and he knows that just the right amount of hot glue is going to get it right on frequency, there's nothing stopping him from putting on a slightly undersized blob of glue. He wants to get it down to 5.8 from 5.9, and he's at 5.82. And he slowly adds little bitty blobs of glue as a tuning element. He can use small amounts of the hot glue as a tuning element to start up an antenna that he knows has been designed high, and now he's bringing it onto frequency by way of the blobs of hot glue he's adding. And the nice thing about the hot glue is you don't have to wait for it to cure and dry and for the fluid in it to evaporate like you do with the Celestic adhesives. The hot glue, once it's slightly cool, settles down to the right dielectric constant. So he can use the hot glue as a tuning element when he starts over the antenna a little bit high. And therefore, maybe he can save some time and doesn't have to go to the elaborate techniques of a tunable stub. To choose the right location for the stub and the right length of the stub is a bit of a rigmarole. But to tune with blobs of hot glue, I think that could work like a charm. Over to you, Bill, ACQIS, K2LIW.
Hey, yeah, I just got a text message from Jesse, who is hearing you on the air. I'm not sure he's able to hit the repeater from where he is. But he's reporting that he has just recently discovered that adding the hot glue makes the antenna resonate approximately 100 megahertz off from what it did prior to adding the hot glue. ACQIS.
As you can tell from my experience, my rules of thumb, I made a wild-ass guess that it's going to move down 100 megs with the glue. It looks like I hit it close. A little bit lucky. I think Jesse's in the background, but very weak. Want to try to make a transmission, Jesse? K2LIW in the TechNet.
God, this is Jesse. KD2IJD. And, yeah, still I'm handheld, so... sorry about that. I'm back in Melbourne right now.
KD2IJD, we're hearing you, Jesse. A little bit noisy. And when the day comes that you use a mag mount on that car connected to your handy talkie, you're going to be 20 dB louder. A rubber duck, if that's what you're using, is a difficult way to go. So any kind of an antenna outside the car with a little bit of altitude is going to work like a charm. Have any further questions or comments, Jesse? Go right ahead. K2LIW.
Yeah, I actually discovered this around Thursday, exactly what you said, that the antennas would resonate perfectly at around 5.9 gigahertz. So by extending the length of it a little bit, I've been able to compensate for that, and now it seems to be working pretty well.
Yeah, I'm anticipating that the blob of glue is adding capacitance. On almost all antennas, adding capacitance moves it down in frequency. So if you started off with a design that's a little bit high, adding the glue is going to bring it right on station. And now tuning with smaller chunks of glue that you add, the glue is a tuning element. The glue is a low-loss tuning element, adding a predictable amount of capacitance. And that's a very crafty way to go. Bill, I wonder if you've got any further things you want to discuss on this subject. ACQIS. K2LIW
in
the TechNet.
This is AC2IS. I guess what I have is a question for Jesse. I was wondering how he measured that that peak resonance, that it was at 5.9 as opposed to 5.8. I was not aware that Jesse's transmitter that he was using would go off frequency that far from 5.8 to 5.9. I'm not sure what method he used to determine this. AC2IS.
Hi, Bill. Well, I've just got a different transmitter. Now, all video transmitters for this frequency usually have at least 8 channels, and they come in about 4 different bands, and each band is a set of 8 channels spaced about 20 to 30 megahertz apart, so covering from almost 5.7 to just about 5.9.
Okay, you have a transmitter that covers a wider range than the one you were using previously. So it was just kind of lucky that you were able to tune that much higher and test again at those frequencies. So wow, that without any you know, any real equipment, you did an amazing job, I think. AC2IS.
Yeah, Bill, and this is the best of all worlds. You've got signal generators that cover all the frequencies you care about, out of band, and you can find out where the new resonance is when you add the blob of glue. However, even if your transmitter is tunable but doesn't go all the way to your new resonant frequency, you can plot a curve of Vizwar versus frequency, see the rate of descent of Vizwar versus frequency as you go to the edge of your transmitter's tuning capability, and still you can make a reasonable prediction as to where the best Vizwar is going to be. So any kind of a tuning transmitter, even if it doesn't cover the whole frequency range, is still giving you darn good information. And whether or not the bottom of the bathtub curve is in the right place, or if it's too high or too low, it's telling you which way to go. It's a little bit like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. The tilt of his shoes tells him which way is uphill. And so the tilt of the Vizwar versus frequency is telling you which way to go. Good luck with that experiment, Bill and Jesse. Exciting-looking antenna, and exotic. And once you perfect the design, I think people are going to be very happy with it. For the particular environment that you're applying it, I'm not sure you need an antenna of that higher performance, which is a little bit vulnerable to being damaged when it hits objects, but that's another whole discussion we've had already. I think we've gone through the list of people who signed in. That's rather a long list. I don't think I've forgotten anybody. Let me double check to make sure that nobody's sitting off to one side getting angry at me. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, that's a good sign. Let's go over to the mailbag, eh, John? And are those guys that write to you, are they going to stump us again? KC2WGB with the mailbag and other things. K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, John.
AC2IS, if I could break in 1 second.
Go ahead, Bill.
I believe that Jesse plans on moving away from his cloverleaf design and moving on to another similar design. I don't think it's going to be any less fragile, but I forget the name of it, and maybe Jesse could chime in with the name of the new antenna design, AC2IS.
Yes. Design is called a Lindenblad antenna. It's designed from Mills Lindenblad, somewhere around 1940.
Now, Lindenblad was the name that I mentioned 1 or 2 weeks ago. It's another very popular circular polarized antenna with four dipole-like elements tilted at a 45-degree angle around the circle. So Lindenblad does give you omnidirectional circular polarization on the horizon, very similar to this cloverleaf-like design. And is one better than the other? It's not clear. They're both, in this environment, going to be a little bit vulnerable to damage as opposed to a simple coaxial whip, which in many cases I think would be good enough. Okay, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW, with it. You've got a John with the mailbag.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. Yes, I know we got to get to Wesley's issue and also Paul, so but I do have one that I have to get out tonight, so we'll take care of this, and that'll be it from the mailbag. Let me let it drop.
I think we can squeeze in two or three. We're not that short of time. Go ahead, John.
Okay, then I'll give you a simple one to start with. This gentleman has a few radios he's working on. They're old, and they have selenium rectifiers. And those selenium rectifiers have resistors bridged across them, which he can't tell the value. But what he wants to do is replace capacitors in that circuit, and he wants to replace them with some silicon diodes that he has. He has 600 volt, 1 ampere diodes, and he just wants to bridge those two seleniums. Now, the question is, the seleniums are 500 milliamps. The diodes are 1 amp. Is that going to create a problem? And do you have any suggestions about any other changes he should make in doing that replacement? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If I understand understand correctly, the seleniums were rated for 500 milliamps, 7 amp, and the diode he's going to replace them with are rated for an ampere. The current rating of a dipole, of a diode, as long as it's high enough, it's good. If you were replacing it with a diode good for 10 amps or 50 amps, it would work like a charm. If you replaced it with a diode that's only good for 50 milliamps, you'd be in trouble. So having a high enough current is good. Having a high enough peak inverse voltage is good. Now, the nasty thing about seleniums is that that was a popular rectifier 40, 50 years ago. They've got some nasty aging characteristics. As a rectifying diode, they're kind of sloppy. You put a curve tracer on a selenium rectifier, they've got quite a bit of forward voltage drop. They got quite a bit of reverse current leakage. They got some nasty characteristics. And because of their aging, and whether or not somebody has scratched the plates, they can have some other grease problems. Let me drop. Common sense would lead you to believe that you simply take your new silicon diodes and put them across the selenium in the right direction, and everything's going to be hunky-dory. But because that selenium there is sitting there with its nasty characteristics of leakage, age, and whatever, my opinion, the safest way to go would be to thoroughly disconnect the selenium, take it out of the circuit. It's not very desirable by modern standards. Plug your solid-state diode in there where the selenium used to be, and everything should be hunky-dory, with one exception, and that is your modern-day selenium diode has only got 7/10 or 9/10 of a volt of forward drop. The seleniums probably had, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it was 20 volts of drop in the forward direction. Therefore, your new solid-state diodes are going to give you higher DC rectified voltage. Let me drop. In some cases, that higher voltage could give you a little bit of grief. Not likely, but it's something to be aware of. And if that does happen, by you putting the right resistor in series with your silicon diode, you can bring that voltage after rectification back down. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you start putting series resistors on a diode rectifier, you've now got a power supply that is very load sensitive. If it's going into a push-pull audio amplifier, when the audio amplifier is turned low, you're not drawing much current. When you turn up the audio amplifier to a loud signal, you're drawing a lot of current, and now your simple series resistor drop is going to give you a lower power supply voltage. You're going to get poor regulation, in other words. So you could go the next step of putting in a voltage regulator, but I don't think you want to go there. So to be a belt and suspenders safe, because selenium rectifiers have got some nasty failure modes, which he may have run into that already, otherwise he wouldn't be considering putting in these silicons, I would recommend thoroughly taking the seleniums out of the circuit. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, yeah, I concur, absolutely. And when they go bad, when they burn, oof, they stink. But he noticed that the paint is peeling on them and things like that, and he's done some work on it. It's only a 180-volt supply, so I don't think he'll have any problems at all. And the current was quite low. So I don't think he'll have an issue with voltage problems. But like I said, he could measure that voltage. That should be very simple. And then take a 5-watt resistor, whatever he needs, and get under control. All right, let me let it drop. We'll go on to the next one.
Now let me go back to that for a minute. If it was a simple rectifier off the 110-volt line, 120 volts RMS gives you something like 167 volts peak voltage, the peak of the sine wave. So a perfect rectifier would only give you 167. So unless there's some kind of a voltage doubler, or unless there's a transformer involved, how does he get 180 volts out of that power supply? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, this has a power transformer in it. It's quite large, too. But there's only those two seleniums that power the whole thing. It only has 7 tubes in it, so it's not a big deal.
Okay, sounds like he's on the right track. And have him come back and tell us how it worked when he made that change. Over to you, John.
Very good. I will do that. All right, now, this next gentleman, this is a serious one. He needs help. He has received an amplifier, linear, I believe, and working. It's a military. It's from the late 60s, and it has two... He doesn't know the numbers, but they're about 3 inches in diameter. So, on the front, he has a power switch, of course. He has a standby switch. And he has a bypass switch. And he has a band switch. It covers from 10 through 80. And then he has the PA load and PA tone drop. And he has tested it with a dummy load, and he his exciter put out about 5 or 10 watts. He also took a receiver. He could hear it did have output. All right. And as he varied the exciter, he could hear it going up and down and could measure it. All right, that's fine. Now, here's his question. It's 400 watts, I think I mentioned that. His question is, he doesn't know how to operate it. He doesn't know how to set those 2 meters, and he's afraid of burning those tubes out. So he could use some instructions. What does he look for in those meters? How does he set them? Are they supposed to be even, or is one low and one high? Maybe you can give him a quick idea of how to tune it safely. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, the two variable capacitors, C1 and C2 as they're usually called, constitute a pi filter final tank circuit on that tube high power amplifier. So pi circuits are very popular with tubes. You get a little bit of a hint of how to properly align that by going to the latest issue of QST, page 58, where this comment to The Doctor Is In by K2RIW mentions that there is a beautiful website giving you a lot of hints about properly tuning a Pi network. It's done by going to whiskey8julietindia.com/loading_amplifier.htm. I'll repeat that. So you go to this website of whiskey8julietindia, a guy who has designed a lot of those amplifiers, and he goes through a very nice description of the proper tuning procedure for a Pi network. So it's www.whiskey8julietindia.com/loading_amplifier.html. The guy's name is Tom Roach. Very nice article. The main thing you got to worry about in the case of very high power amplifiers, kilowatt level and above, let me drop, is that the first capacitor, they usually call it C1, is called the tuning capacitor, and the C2 capacitor is usually starting, is called the loading capacitor. Common sense would lead you to believe that if you set the loading very light, in other words, the C2 capacitor set for high capacitance, light loading of the tube, you're starting off with light loading, and you're slowly creeping up on the tube, so to speak, and that sounds like good common sense. Wrong. Opposite. You should start off with heavy loading, because if you've got the loading capacitor, the C2 capacitor, set for heavy loading, correction, light loading, that means that capacitor is mostly closed. Not as much RF is being sent out. You've now got a whole lot of resonant energy in that Pi network. Therefore, the peak voltage on your amplifying tube, your high-power tube, goes to high voltages, and you can easily arc that tube over. And each arc is damaging. It could potentially damage your exciter. That's the whole reason for that submittal of mine. Exciter damage, because that arced tube sent a 3,000-volt spike back to the exciter and burned out those transistors, is my guess as to what was happening on that particular amateur's problem. So, starting off with heavy loading is the desirable way to go. Then you rock the C1 capacitor, the tuning capacitor. Let me drop it. You rock it back and forth to find resonance. Resonance is indicated by the plate current going to a dip and the output power or voltage going to a maximum. That's when you hit resonance. So if you've got a bird watt meter, so to speak, on the output of the amplifier going to the dummy load, and you simply rock those controls until you see maximum forward power, that's usually the best tuning. And to start off with slightly heavier than normal loading, in other words, the C1 capacitor more closed in the beginning, is the desirable way to start off to make sure you don't arc over the tube. So Once you've gone through the tuning procedure a couple of times of a Pi network, it's nowhere near as complicated as you think, but it's something you have to get a feel for. You've got to do it a few times, and pretty soon you'll know what normal characteristics are like when you're watching output power or you're watching final plate current. At resonance, final plate current will be at a dip. Let me drop. But the lowest possible dip as far as the loading control is concerned, the lowest possible dip of plate current near the point of maximum power output, but it is not at that point. There's another setting, so to speak, an ideal setting for the loading control, the second capacitor, which will give you not quite as deep a dip on the current, on the plate current as you rock the tuning control, but it will be maximum power output. So the best way to tune, in my opinion, is with some kind of a forward power indicator. Could even be something as simple as measuring the voltage being supplied, the RF voltage being supplied to the dummy load. If you peak the voltage, RF voltage being supplied to the dummy load as you rock these controls, you're doing the right thing. You'll also notice something else funny about high power tube amplifiers with a Pi tuning network. Let me drop. Let's assume that this is a kilowatt amplifier. And let's assume that the kilowatt amplifier gives you the kilowatt output with 25 watts of drive from your exciter transmitter. But you're sneaking up on the tuning, and you start off with 10 watts of drive. At 10 watts of drive, maybe the power output maximum of the amplifier is 500 watts instead of 1,000. Set the tuning and loading controls on the Pi network at 10 watts of drive, and you see the 500 watts of output. And you say, aha, I've got a tune just right. Then you go to the 25 watts of drive, where it's capable of a kilowatt of output. You will have to readjust both of those controls, tuning and loading. So tuning and loading at maximum performance is only for a particular drive level. The tube amplifier is drawing bigger chunks of current, and therefore it has a lower RF plate impedance when you drive it harder with 25 watts. So when you find the ideal tuning controls of the tuning and loading, it's only for a particular drive level. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW. I bet you've seen some of those characteristics on amplifiers.
Yes, and I've seen those tubes flash over when they're not set properly. All right, so basically his instructions, when he starts off with his low exciter input, C1 should be closed, C2 should be opened, and he should rock them around a little bit. This amplifier is only 400 watts, and he says it has 2,800 volts on the plate of those two tubes. That's pretty high for that 400-watt amplifier. And so with that setup, he has a way to start, and he can play with there from there. There's no name on this amplifier, but it looks like an old military item, but it does have a label, and the band switch, like I said, covers 10 to 80. So I would say he should go somewhere middle band, maybe. He has a nice little antenna that he's been working with just the radio with his transceiver, and the antenna performs pretty well, so he's not worried about an antenna problem. All right, I think that gives him a good start and a way to go.
Yeah. Let me add some words to this. Your recommendation is he starts off with the loading capacitor closed and the tuning capacitor open. That's not a bad starting position. And then he's going to first rock the tuning capacitor until he sees a plate current dip and power output starting to happen. That means he's hitting resonance. However, when you start off out of resonance with drive power applied, even a small amount of drive power, when the tube is out of resonance, it's drawing a pretty big glob of current. It's dissipating all of that power, because before you hit resonance, none of the power is coming out of the amplifier. All of the power you're putting into it is becoming plate heating of the plate element, the anode of the tube. Therefore, do not dwell there very long, out of resonance. A smart guy will be turning on the exciter by pressing down a Morse code key, and he's doing it intermittently. He presses it down for a couple of seconds, does a little bit of tuning, and lets up. until you hit resonance, all of the power from your power supply, current and voltage going into that tube is making the anode hot, and you don't want to melt down the tube. So don't dwell for long periods of time with drive in an amplifier that's out of resonance. Run it intermittently, short periods of time, until you hit resonance. And then you can leave it on for longer periods of time. So go easy with the tube. You don't want to overheat it. And yes, you're not going to be running into arcing problems if you start off with the loading capacitor fully meshed. That's not the ideal place to be, but it's safe as far as arcing over the amplifier is concerned. A resonant amplifier, let me drop it. Oh, I'm saying it backwards. In order for the loading to be heavy, you want the output loading capacitor to be opened, not closed. So the loading capacitor, the C2 capacitor, the loading capacitor is opened. That's heavy loading. If you started off with that capacitor closed, you're going to arc over the tube. So C2 is, the loading capacitor is maximum opened. C1 capacitor, where you start off with it, doesn't matter. You're going to be tuning around to find resonance. There's no ideal place to start off with this. But to make sure you've got heavy loading, which is the safest way for the tube, opposite of common sense, heavy loading is the loading capacitor unmeshed. And at first, do it intermittently until you hit resonance with the tuning capacitor. You don't want to run key down for 5 minutes with the amplifier out of tune. You'll burn up the tube. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I think he should be able to complete that in like a 15-second cycle until he gets close to the proper loading. I don't think that'll give him any problem, but yeah, if he stayed on there a minute or two, that may give him an issue. All right, very good.
Coming.
Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, we're talking about the selenium, and although it's no longer being used as a semiconductor in rectifiers, selenium is also a photoconductor, and not many people knows about it. Material that changes light energy into the electrical energy. So directly photons come into the surface of selenium are being changed to low current. So it becomes better at making this conversion at the light intensity or brighter intensity. But there is another application for it. Because it's photoconductive, the full selenium photoconductor based on the flat panel X-ray detectors can provide excellent images and can directly convert X-ray radiation pattern to electronic signals. So it is the most highly developed photoconductor, and it's still the only practical photoconductor for clinical medical X-ray sensors. And that is because it is acceptable, an acceptable X-ray absorption coefficients is high, and it's good transport properties for both holes and electrons. Also, the dark current in a C is smaller than the competing polycrystalline layers. So, a plenty of applications. I wonder how much of selenium is left. It's a rare earth metal. Back to you.
Sure does sound like selenium is interesting material with some great photovoltaic properties. I don't think it's being used on photovoltaic cells that they put on roofs of houses, and sounds like it's a slightly rare and expensive material. But at one time it was the popular kind of rectifier in the early days of tube amplifier circuits. Back to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Well, that worked out well because this gentleman was very interested in getting this amplifier online and not blowing it up, and he got it free. It was somebody's basement, and when he plugged it in, everything seemed to light up and work well. Okay, that's it from the mailbag, Dick, and let's go on to Paul, hear what some exciting news he must have.
In the case of high power afterburner like amplifiers, in the multi-hundred watt to kilowatt like level, when they've been sitting around for a long time, many of them contain voltage doubler circuits with great big electrolytic capacitors. These great big electrolytic capacitors do dry out in time, and their number of microfarads goes to very small numbers and or have voltage arc over characteristics. So if somebody's got a high power amplifier that's been sitting on the shelf for a while and you turn it on, many people use a so-called de-aging, that's not the right word, burn-in. They slowly sneak up on the supplied voltage to the amplifier by way of a variac in order to reform those tantalum capacitors, those electrolytic capacitors. When electrolytic capacitors, aluminum electrolytics I think they're called, when they've been sitting on the shelf for a long period of time, they do require some reforming, and you should sneak up on the voltage more slowly and then do some testing to make sure that they haven't dried out, that they still have the right amount of microfarads to them. So an amplifier that's been well aged on a shelf without being run for a while, be a little bit careful the first time you turn it on. Oh, hey Paul, WS2N, a man with the space report. I think this is going to be space report number 188. So I'm pretty sure that Voyager is happy. I'm pretty sure we're proceeding very well with the James Webb Infrared Space Telescope, which is going to be launched in 2018. I think it is late. So great things going on in space, and bring us up to speed, Paul. And great things happen with reference to gravity wave detection. We're just starting to get into a brand new kind of astronomy, gravity wave astronomy. Who would have...
Repeater, timeout.
Who would ever believe that gravity wave astronomy is going to become a brand new field? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Give me a brief transmission. Let's see how you're coming through tonight.
Last 2N. Yes, Dick, last week was a good... I knew that was going to be a good topic with gravity wave detection. And then, of course, I'm interested in the LISA project. That's the spacecraft that's testing out equipment for future gravitational wave detection. How's the copy, Dick?
Extremely good. Please proceed.
I'll start with the newest news. The Cygnus spacecraft, they call it OA-4 for orbital, orbital science company, which has now changed the name to another name. What was the A-4? I forgot that. Orbital. I'll think of it. That's the one that blew up back in 2014 in October when I was leaving Wallops Island. And, got a mile up and just blew up. And that was the end of the that particular mission. It put them way behind schedule. And they have a contract with NASA for 8 supply missions. ATK, by the way, is the name of the company I'm trying to think of. Orbital ATK is now the name of the company. They rebuilt everything. The Antares spacecraft, the Antares rocket is not ready to launch the spacecraft yet. That will be done probably this May. So what they did is they contracted with Boeing and Lockheed. They have a company called United Launch Alliance that launches all the Atlas V rockets to launch their Cygnus spacecraft to put the contract for NASA. So they did that back in December, and they plan on doing it in probably about another month or so. Let me drop it. So they made a deal for two Atlas V rockets to get their Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station. And rocket that they're building, new Antares rocket will be ready. It will have new engines. They did away with the NK-33 Russian engines, and they actually put different Russian engines in the 191s. But they'll be ready, and they'll continue many flights. They had a contract for 8. They were extended to 10, and then they just got all three different companies. Orbital ATK, Sierra Nevada, with their Dream Chaser, and Boeing, SpaceX with the Dragon cargo vehicle to get many more cargo flights to the space station all the way through 2024 at this time. Drop it. The enhanced Cygnus was attached to the space station since December. So there's a difference. These have these rectangular solar panels sticking out of it. The new enhanced one has these big round ones, about 15 feet in diameter, two of them. They open up like a fan, and they supply about the same amount of kilowatts, about 4,000 kilowatts as the last ones, but they're much lighter. More reliable. The spacecraft is also extended. It's longer. It holds more cargo. So they're back in business. So I thought that was pretty good. You mentioned James Webb Space Telescope. Well, tonight, it's over now. I mentioned last week they had a television show on Channel 170, the Science Channel. It was actually on Discovery yesterday. All about the James Webb Space Telescope. Very good show, very, very informative. You get more technical information probably from the TechNet than you will from them, but it's still very well done. I watched it and I learned a few things. Let me drop it. So, James Webb will be launched to the L2 position in 2018. You're right about that, Dick. And that'll be sitting out there for about 10 years, a 10-year operation. Then it will eventually be joined by a newer program that they have. I've been talking about it on the net for quite a while, called the W-FIRST telescope. This is the one that the National Reconnaissance Office had a couple of extra telescopes that they never launched into space. They were going to be spy satellites, and they had the same diameter mirrors as the Hubble Space Telescope. So they said to NASA, do you want them? And they said, okay, but we'll just take one for now. And they're going to convert it, rebuild it, and call it the W-FIRST. It's going to be an infrared telescope. It will have a much wider view than the Hubble Space Telescope. We'll be able to see 100 times wider, but with the same clarity. Things have improved since 1990. Hubble has been up there for like over 25 years, and time has moved on. So this thing's going to be a very good instrument. And maybe a couple of months ago, I thought maybe they were going to put this thing in orbit around the Earth. Well, that's not what they're going to do. And they're going to send it out to the to join the James Webb Space Telescope at L2, launch point 2, 1 million miles away from the Earth, roughly four times the distance of the Moon. And then that will sit out there as well. And that will go into a halo orbit. And similar to James Webb Space Telescope, so that should be pretty good. They expect to have like a 6 or 7 year life to W-FIRST. James Webb is about 10 years. They're both very heavy vehicles. James Webb weighs about 14,000 pounds, and W-FIRST is a little bit lighter, probably around 10 or 11, 12,000 pounds, something like that. So, interesting world, and new telescopes to be
launched in space. That will be launched probably by Falcon 9 Heavy. I bring Falcon 9 and bolt it together. Drop it. That'll probably be launched from Florida in around 2024. James Webb Space Telescope. That's been contracted with the European Space Agency for decades now to be launched by the Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana, Kourou, down in South America. So, there we go. And then moving on to a couple of other things that was just launched last week is the Astro H. That's another telescope launched by Japan. And that was successfully launched around 31 degrees inclination, around 400 miles up. And that's an X-ray telescope. So, you know, there's mostly communication satellites were always being launched, but I like announcing the scientific ones. And it's good to follow. One other thing this week, I'll keep a watch out for Falcon 9. Is going to be launching a communication satellite from Florida, the SES number 9, drop it. Going to geosynchronous orbit, and the plan for the booster is to try to salvage it, and they plan on trying to land it on another barge out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And it's going to be different from the last time they launched from Cape Canaveral. They actually sent the booster back and successfully landed on Launch Complex number 1, they're calling it, Landing Zone number 1, the old Launch Complex 13 at Cape Canaveral. This time, because it's going to a geosynchronous orbit, they need a lot more power, a lot more fuel to launch SES-9 to its geosynchronous location. It's going to put the booster too far downrange to make a boost back all the way to Florida. So they plan on trying to, I guess for a fourth time now, try to land it onto a barge. And if they do, it'll be the first successful time. They get closer each time, every time they do the barge. Last time they missed, the landing leg broke when they launched Jason 3 out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, and almost made it. Landed on the barge, but then tipped over. Back to you, Dick, for any questions, comments. Let me drop it for a second.
That barge is going to be how many miles downrange from the launch point? What's your guess on that one, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, one time they tried it, they had around almost 250 miles out, I think it was. This one is a heavier satellite and a lot more fuel on board to do that. So all the launches of Falcon 9s are new and improved. They have a lot more thrust coming out of the rocket. The tanks are extended a little bit further. Fuels are cooled down. Usually oxygen is, so liquid oxygen they have cryogenically cooled to fit more of it in. They're going about 50 degrees lower. And the same with the RP-1, the rocket propellant fuel, which is really kerosene that they use for fuel, and they're going to drop that 50 degrees lower than they normally do to get more fuel on board. And with that, from what I understand, it seems like they're going to have a lot further down range. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was 300-400 miles out. I'll find out. We'll know for sure next week how they did. Back to you, Dick.
Nick.
If there was a pilot on board and looking out the window and landing on the barge, I can see how that works. How does that booster find the barge? Is there a beacon transmitter on the barge? and the booster lines up on that beacon transmitter. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Well, I know they use a lot of systems. Number one is the GPS. And then, they do have beacons. They have, there's radar, I understand, on board the booster. It tells them different things, not only where, where the boosters are, but at what point they have to, they have to ignite the rockets three different times. After they deploy the payload, you have nine engines on the first stage that they're trying to reuse. So after the nine engines, three engines fire, and after they separate from the payload, they have cold jets. They call them cold jets. They're nitrogen jets that flip the whole rocket around 180 degrees, and then they do a boost back. Three of the rockets, and then as they're coming down, straight down, they fire the three rockets one more time, and then as they get closer to the booster right at the very end, just the center rocket is, there's nine rockets, and they're all in a circle except for the middle one. That just the center one fires. They're highly gimbaled. You can see when they, on the video replay, that the angle that this flame is coming out of.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The radar also tells them when to open up the these flaps. There's four fins near the top of the booster. That's up. Those four fins really help guide it to its location. All the computations are done on board the booster, and this is all done autonomously. And using the fins, they articulate two different directions, and it actually guides the, using the air, the atmosphere, will guide them. When this all starts happening, 58 miles up, there's really virtually no air, so it's actually almost in space when this all starts. But by the time it comes down, it picks up air, and you're able to use these fins that pop out at the top to use aerodynamics to guide it to the barge. The barge is about as big as a football field. Back to you, Jeff.
The astronaut that's on board the International Space Station that's spending a year, I think he has just accomplished the year. I believe he's about to come back in the next month or two, and he's an identical twin, if I understand correctly. His identical twin is on the ground. He's up in space for a year, and when they come back, of course, they're going to do all kinds of medical testing to find out how much bone loss, how much muscle decrease, and so on. So I presume he's going to come back down on a Voyager, on a Soyuz, and I think that takes place in the next month or so. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Scott Kelly. He will be coming back on March 2nd. Brother Mark is the identical twin. He's also an astronaut. He's been up to the space station. They're both pilots. They come out of Jersey, and they do a comparative test between the two. If anybody wants to try to do ESP, I can guarantee it doesn't work, because I know for a fact I am an identical twin, so I know how they feel. They'll just do biological tests. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so Scott and Mark. Now, Mark has also been on the space station. That means that it's not quite as pure a test as I thought. I thought that Mark had never been in space. So Mark has spent some time in space, a hell of a lot less than Scott. but still, Scott's a much longer duration. It's still an interesting comparison. Now, you're an identical twin. Okay. You've done the ESP tests, and you think there isn't any. That doesn't surprise me. Your identical twin, is he an engineer? Where does he live? Give me a couple words about your identical twin. That's brand new information to me, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, he's over in Nassau County. So, involved with the same thing I was involved with, Steve Fitter, for the 1970s. So, there you go. Not a ham, though, but highly interested in the space program. Back to you, Dick.
So your identical twin was in the identical occupation, but he's not a ham, and you're heavily involved in ham radio. That's quite a contrast. Did your identical twin marry a similar-looking lady? Oh, would you recall?
No. No. It's wishful thinking. What is it? 1 out of 600 people fall into my category. And ask any one of them, all the stories, none of them are true. Everybody's an individual. The thing that sometimes holds true, of course, is the occupation. Look at Mark Kelly and Scott Kelly, both astronauts, both flew the space shuttle. At one time, it was going to be possible, but they wound up having a delay in one of the flights. They were both actually going to wind up on the space station at the same time, the way the schedule fell. But it's, you know, what happened was it was a delay in one of the missions and canceled. And by that time, the one brother came home. But that would have been the first for the space station. This is WS2N.
Now, Paul, is your identical twin brother older or younger than you? I'm guessing one of you was born 10 minutes later than the other. But whoever is the older one, of course, takes all the flack for he's older and he should know better. So are you the younger or the older identical twin, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm younger. Who's to say they didn't make specs everybody up? Do you think they really know? What are you going to do? Back to you, then.
So I'm guessing your older brother is 10 minutes older than you. Of course, that makes a big difference. And the people who study the signs of the zodiac can read all kinds of meaning into that. Now, we're on the subject of space. Anyone have any further questions for Paul on anything you want to know about the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency, NASA, European Southern Observatory, anything you want to know? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW, the TechNet.
I'd like to know if Paul's brother's fingerprints match his closely.
Yes.
How closely?
I didn't say yes. Somebody else said yes for a question. Holy cow. But no, that's it. No. It's not close. No. I love all those rumors. Back to you, Dick.
Was there another person who had a space question? Give us your call letters right now.
WA2RYY.
Go right ahead, Joe.
I actually have two questions with the realm of this discussion, with the space stuff. First thing was I'm just kind of curious. These rockets that are coming down, Paul, do they have to carry enough fuel to be able to do a burn as they're going to slow down? Because I would imagine as they're approaching, you know, a zero speed, it requires enough thrust, forward thrust, to equal the weight, the entire weight of this rocket coming down. So wouldn't that mean substantial that they've got to come, you know, carry a substantial amount of fuel in reserve to be able to use that fuel if it's like so many minutes or seconds of time to be able to slow them down to almost like 0 miles per hour? Back to you.
You've got it, Paul.
Yeah, in the beginning when they were first doing it, it was something like 30%. Now they've cut that number way back. back. I don't know what it is now. You know, with the cryogenically cooled fuel. So now he's not too worried about the cost. When I say he, Elon Musk, because the cost of let's call it one tank of gas in a Falcon 9 is $200,000.